I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
I've been getting so many messages since we started the show saying, Paul, when are you going to have a female? When are you going to have a woman? Well, today we have not just any woman, but an incredibly gifted, incredibly talented director, artistic director. And she has been a trailblazer throughout the industries of theater and film. And I think you're really going to enjoy this. So please, without further ado, let's get into the psychology of success. Hi, everyone, and welcome back or welcome to the psychology of success. I'm Paul McVeigh, and as a professional footballer, I was always fascinated by the ability to continuously improve in all that you do. And a turning point for me was when I started to look outside the world of football to understand what elite performance looked like, which leads me nicely on to my next guest, who has excelled in the worlds of film and theatre. She's worked with everyone from Sam Mendes, Helen Mirren, Daniel Radcliffe, and everyone in between, and was also the first female artistic director of the Donmar Theatre in London. So please welcome Josie Rourke. Josie, how are you doing?
Thank you very much for having me. Yeah, good. Yeah. I'm in my kitchen in Suffolk, contemplating being able to go into a pub for the first time in a long time. Yeah, so it's a good day.
Great. Well, listen, I really appreciate you joining us. And I know that we're going to talk about all of the professional standards and the world-class people that you've worked with over your career. But did you just about get your mum out of the house before we started?
I just about got my mum out of the house. She gets very, very excited when I do anything, really. I mean, the first movie I directed, Mary Queen of Scots, which was a big deal, right? I get my mum onto set and they're really lovely with her and they're all great. We're shooting in Oxford. It's a big scene. You know, Margot Robbie, Adrian Lester, Guy Pearce, these amazing actors, about 60 extras. And they've sat my parents down at the monitor, they're giving them chairs, they've got tea, coffee, they're really looking after them. And I thought my mum would be kind of cowed by the whole setting, just like a bit sort of, you know, on her back foot or something. And I do three takes, and bear in mind, I've never directed a film before, right, in which I'm directing Margot Robbie. So Margot does three, and I come back to the monitor, my face full of expectation, waiting to see my mum just fill up with pride or, you know, just be overwhelmed by what I've done. She looks at me, she goes, the second take. Unbelievable. I mean, she's just absolutely amazing. And she's here at the moment, so I think she'd have some thoughts maybe on what was going on already. But yeah, so and it's so great. I've missed them. I'm from the north of England originally. I've really, really missed them. So it's great to be able to see her, even if she
I think we're probably going to come into all of those different stories that you might have over your incredible career. But I suppose it's the fact that, you know, we're just talking about your mum and growing up in the north of England, as you just mentioned there, that's probably actually a better place to start, just to understand, you know, for someone like yourself who grew up, I think you were from Manchester, who you're then kind of going from a kind of, you know, a pretty normal upbringing like myself, you know, working class, and suddenly going from that to directing and working with all of those incredible actors that you mentioned. But what was the starting point for you? How did you kind of, as a child, just have these starry-eyed dreams of just always wanting to get into this industry?
So I'm just going to do like the tiniest adjustments to that, because I think it's really important to go. I think I'm probably not working class. I think that I'm sort of what you'd call kind of lower middle class. I'm always a bit cautious about, in the arts particularly, people sometimes overclaiming or not quite understanding the background they came from. So my mum was a teacher and she was an English teacher. So I'm unbelievably privileged in the sense that, you know, she taught me to read when I was really young and she took me to the theatre. And I definitely had parents who were lucky enough in the jobs that they were doing to be able to introduce me to that. And I'm from Salford. Salfordians are always very keen to point out that Salford is not Manchester. That's a small detail to the rest of the world, but a big detail to us. Although actually, like you, Paul, I did grow up Catholic and went to Catholic comprehensive schools and was state educated in Salford. And it's certainly true, you know, I was probably one of the poshest kids in my class. For my class, because my mum was a teacher. So one thing I'm enormously grateful for actually is my parents didn't privately educate me. Not that they could have particularly afforded to, but you know, I came from a place where the people I was at school with have gone on to do a huge variety of jobs. And yeah, it's probably regarded as relatively exceptional that I went to become a theatre director and then a film director. There's a kind of level of glamour to that. And certainly when I went to my posh university, I realized how much there was a movement from people's family backgrounds into the media, into the arts, that it just felt more natural because they saw it and their parents did it and it was part of it. So that's the adjustment that I'd make there. What I would say, and this is clearly going to be a podcast entirely about my mom, is that she's had her first grandchild recently, so I've got this niece, Delilah, who's amazing. But the thing that I've really realised, and actually I think probably my biggest privilege, has been my parenting, because the attention that my parents give to Delilah and the way they celebrate her creativity, and my dad particularly will like play any game she invents and run after any story. And I don't think it's just a grandparent thing. I think they did this with me as well, just the depth of kind of playfulness and imagination and all of those things. And also, and I know again, all grandparents do this, but anything she invents, they really celebrate. So I think I spent a lot of my childhood being praised for making things up and being praised for making up stories by my parents. And I'm sure that's a big part of what got me into storytelling and into the arts. So, you know, that's what got me there. I was listening to some of your other fantastic podcasts and you were talking about background and Catholicism. I think another big part of it probably, and I'd be interested to know what you think about this, is that there's a lot of no in Catholicism and there's a lot of don't and a lot of shouldn't. And some people talk about that as being a very repressive thing. I think I was highly motivated by that being a kind of dare. I don't just mean like by being naughty or by being transgressive or by being sinful. I just mean, I think I'm extremely driven as a person by the idea that you can't do something. If someone tells me you can't do something, I will immediately want to go and try and do it. And I think a lot of that was sort of to do with a Catholic upbringing, really, and a sort of sense of defiance as a driving force, or defiance of a no.
There's so many things that I need to pick up on there. Firstly, apologies like if you're like not boom. Working class. Secondly, not Manchester. I know that's a big deal. I do know that's a big deal. But it is interesting when you start talking about those kind of, you know, crucial years that your parents were spending with you and what they were doing with you, because you're talking about the creativity, was the opportunity and celebrating that, whereas I don't know if I ever had that. And I don't know whether that's just because I wasn't creative or whether it's because I never did anything that my parents could celebrate. But even with, you know, being supported and coming from a loving background, that doesn't necessarily mean you go on to what you call it, a posh university, going to Cambridge University. You know, that doesn't necessarily mean that you will have the abilities or the drive or the belief even that you can go on and have this kind of, or at least a starting point in a career of either in film or theatre.
I guess it's like you, isn't it? Like, I'd be interested to know when you realised you were brilliant at football. So yeah, definitely there's a base level of skill that you need, or aptitude or facility, that allows you to build from that place. But you know, when when did you work that out, that this is maybe something I could do professionally? Or, you know, when did somebody say to you about your amazing skill in sport, I'm identifying you as exceptional within this group?
But I think I had a slightly different journey with it, because I, because of my size, you know, being a little shorter, being 5'6", I was fine up until 9 or 10 before, you know, the hormones kicked in and everyone started getting bigger. So I was one of the better players at that age. And then as soon as 12, 13, 16, 18, and then I never was ever at the top of the sort of the group anymore. But I think that might have been slightly different for you.
I think for me, probably what happened is that I had some really good teachers who encouraged bits of creativity in me. But the big thing for me is that actually they didn't do loads of drama at my school. So I tried to get onto the drama GCSE course, but because I wanted to do a language, I wasn't able to. And they actually only started doing sort of student productions a year after I left. So I went right the way through from primary education to 16 without really doing any sort of acting as a kid or being in a school play or anything. What that did make me, and I think this is part of the directing thing, is a massive fan of theatre before I got to do theatre and fascinated by it. So in a way, being kind of held back from being able to practice it. When I got to a sixth form college that did plays and I was in one for the first time, the sort of sense of revelation was really profound. That actually it was a revelation that I was absolutely awful at acting, just really, really bad. Like I sort of, and maybe it was because I worked since I was 16, but I had enough self-knowledge to know that I was being terrible in this play. But the other revelation that came with it was one that was about a kind of 360 about what was going on around me, and a sense that there was a role you could take that was kind of a shaping role, that was a director's role. I didn't direct until I got to university, where I turned up and just basically lied that I directed some school plays and managed to get some funding to do some student drama there. But it was a kind of much later thought about, wow, this is a job and a thing that I can do, that really began that idea for me. Up until then, I think I thought I wanted to be a version of a writer and a reader, like maybe someone who maybe like an academic. I was very, very bookish, so I think I thought I'd be a kind of lady academic and write novels maybe in the summer holidays, was my plan, which would have been a nightmare for me because I'm so sociable. It would almost have been the worst job that I could have picked, but that was my route into directing.
But whenever you then, as you say, you almost tried the act and realized potentially either it's not for you or maybe you're not at the standard, but then also saw this maybe spark or passion for directing, how did that suddenly take you into Cambridge University? And, you know, I know you're being very humble, you know, you kind of blagged your way, but you can only blag your way for so long unless you're performing at that level.
Look, I was super academic. I was a very, and partly it's because there wasn't a lot of extracurricular stuff going on at school. So I really threw myself into, you know, my GCSEs and my study. Again, my parents reminded me the other day that I made myself a GCSE revision timetable that popped up. So there was still a degree of relentless creativity going on there, I think. But yeah, I was really, I just worked really hard at school. And worked really hard at my A-levels. And then because I was reading so much, I sort of read about the idea that you could go to Oxford or Cambridge. So no one in my school had ever been, and I'd never really met anybody who'd been to one of those two fancy universities. But because I'd sort of read about people going in 19th and 20th century novels, I thought, oh, I might try this. I mean, I think a key point here is that I am deeply, deeply fanciful. So I am someone who thinks if you read something in a book, you can make it happen, which in some way I've kind of managed to do in my professional life by literally adapting books and films for the from novels and things. So, you know, I think there's always been a kind of link for me between being able to imagine yourself into a place. So I just sort of worked out really how to apply with a bit of help from a teacher who had a brother who was at Oxford, I think. And actually, to go back to the top of this conversation, so I went to Cambridge from 1995 to 1998. And it's not gigantically improved since, but the balance of people from comprehensive schools to people from private education was still very, very uneven in terms of how it reflects the country. And I think what happened to me is that I came across an academic there who was trying to correct that balance. So they were very, very keen, even though I didn't necessarily have the coaching that some people have to get into that university, that I get there. And actually, I wound up doing two interviews and getting a 2E offer, which is sort of ridiculous because it kind of meant that I didn't, I mean, I did do my A-levels because I was still very bookish, but they just really wanted me in that space. And I think partly because they were going, let's try and balance out this space a little bit, to go back to your comment at the top that I'm working class. I'm definitely from a working class community. I'm not from a working class background. And I think that was a keenness in that university at that point that has improved since, to try and balance it out a little bit. So that's how I think I got in. I mean, I was clever and stuff, you know, and I worked hard, but it was certainly because of that as well.
You're listening to the Psychology of Success podcast with Paul McVeigh, sponsored by Moment Digital Limited, live streaming and video producers creating live event content that looks like TV shows, broadcast quality without the cost. Check us out at moment-digital.co.uk.
Now, Josie, how does this happen? Because you're talking about you're one of the kind of the small minority coming from someone who went from a comprehensive school into Cambridge University. And then, of course, we know that the imbalance of male versus female artistic directors, directors, producers across the entire worlds of film and theatre is incredibly uneven. So how did you start to make headway in that world?
So I think I'm massively motivated to go to your idea of success by the idea of doing something nobody's done before, or doing something for the first time, or doing something that people or history say can't do, or shouldn't do, or are not going to succeed at. And I think that the idea that there weren't very many women theatre directors, that it was a profession that was very hard to enter as a woman, and that there was very little precedent, actually was a gigantically motivating force for me, which I again would root back into that sort of great Catholic don't that sits in my childhood, certainly. I don't know about yours. So to a certain degree, and a kind of in an awful way, it was an act of defiance. And definitely when I entered the profession, it was unbelievably male, very, very white. You didn't see yourself to a large extent represented within those jobs, which is not that there were not pioneering women theatre directors, and there have been since the 60s, and pioneering women artistic directors, although not very many. The most famous one being an amazing woman called Joan Littlewood, who in the 60s and 70s ran a theatre in East London, Theatre Hall Stratford East, who's a bit of a hero of mine. So there were examples, but not very many. It's certainly true to say that, again, a bit like my story about someone within Cambridge who was a white man wanting to try and do something that is corrective to a balance in terms of class or the class I presented. I think it was the case that when I came out as a director or an assistant director, because there's a very clear training route where you assist senior directors as you're training, there was a desire to try and start to correct some of that balance on the part of the men that were running those institutions. So I was very championed by Sam Mendes, who was running the Donmar Warehouse, Michael Grandage, who was running Sheffield, Ian Rickson gave me a job at the Royal Court early doors. So, you know, they were trying to get more women in, I mean, partly because it was so stark, but also, you know, there were great mentors and great champions. I think the other thing to say is that you start out in theatre as an assistant director. And what I'd done after I graduated from Cambridge is I'd realised that I just, because that's where the main bulk of the work was, again, this has changed now to an extent, is get to London. And I spent 9 months working nights as a banking secretary in a mergers and acquisitions bank and trying to do theatre stuff during the days. And in a way, I think getting that role as an assistant director and being a successful assistant, probably the banking has as much influence on that as the Cambridge University degree did, because I spent 9 months working as quite a high level PA. So on the assistant level, where you're making sure somebody's got what they need when they need it, anticipating in that way that a really amazing assistant does, what's going to happen next and what's going to be required for it, ahead of the person that you're working with. I was just brilliant at it because I'd been in this kind of pressurized banking environment for 9 months. So all of those people I assisted at the Donmar, I think found me to be a really good assistant to them. And also they gained confidence, and it gains you a bit of space, right? They listen to you. Like, if you're a good assistant, you get space with and around the people that you're working with. I think it gave them the confidence to listen to me artistically and creatively. But that was built on a basis of going, there's your pen, just as they sort of go, where's the pen? You know, the kind of very functional stuff. And in an amazing sort of break, and this is relatively unprecedented, I was Sam Mendes' assistant at the Donmar for a year, and then Sam gave me a show at the Donmar. So my professional debut was at the Donmar Warehouse, which for people who don't know is a very, very established theatre. It's one of the most established theatres. It's a small space, but it's one of the most established and celebrated theatres in the world. And Michael Grandage, who I was also assisting, gave me a show at Sheffield, The Crucible, which does plays and snooker that he was running at that point. So normally you would spend a long time having assisted, treading water and trying to get early gigs and working your way up through the fringe. I just went right in at two very established houses. So I was directing at quite fancy theatres from my early 20s. So in that sense, my career transitioned from assistant to director very, very swiftly. But I would say a lot of that is just built on the basis of being an excellent PA as well as a good director. And also some of it, I think, and this is a piece of advice that I try and give to people when they're starting out as assistants, is that you can often think that the most value you're making is when you're making a contribution to the rehearsal room. So when you're saying, here's my opinion, or let's change it that way, or here's something that's artistic. Actually, for me, the greatest value I found in a rehearsal room was when I could just sit quietly and watch. Because that period of observation that you get as a director, when you get to watch other directors practice their craft, is extremely limited. Because once you're established as a director and you can do it and you're working, other directors don't really want you in their room watching you, watching them do their stuff. You know, you're not a threat necessarily, but that space is not a space that you can enter if you're their peer. So that year to 2 years that I spent being an assistant and watching those amazing, amazing directors do their stuff and sitting quietly and not trying to sort of go, there's my hand up, I think this should be this. Not making intervention or making myself heard in the space was insanely valuable.
Again, almost like it's back to the very start of the conversation of so many things to pick up from your first answer. On this answer, again, there just seems to be so many huge points for me, because, you know, it's really interesting to me to hear your journey of how you started off and where you got to. And then, of course, we're talking about being at the Donmar Theatre. But of course, you know, everything that I do, especially around this Psychology of Success podcast, is really about trying to understand what success looks like. What is elite performance? You know, how do you get to the very top of your industry? And suddenly you're there working with and being around, and you said observing Sam Mendes. So that's really where I want to go with this. Josie, how do you then look at someone who is clearly performing at the highest level? And it doesn't really matter what industry that in. How do you take things from that? And then how can you apply them to your own performance?
So I think, and I'm going to try and make a sort of sports analogy here, and it's probably going to go wrong.
Because is this because I'm not a very bright footballer? Is this why you're bringing back the sports analogy?
No, it's because actually Sam uses sports analogies all the time. But it's interesting, right? Because rehearsal rooms are really you're wonderful and amazing, and but rehearsal rooms are really odd spaces, right? Not very many people get to go in them. They're a bit mysterious, like what happens in there. It's not like sport where if you want to see something happen, you can probably, I don't know, go and watch a training session or something. I don't know, you tell me. But the mystery of the rehearsal room, like, where does this thing happen where you rehearse a play and make it, and what occurs in that room? And they can be sometimes with too much piety, quite sacred spaces, right? So you really need permission to get in there if you're not part of the cast or the director. With Sam, what was amazing for me, because when a director's playing, right, when we play our match or practice our sport, that's in the rehearsal room, it's not on the stage. So when you see an actor at the height of their craft in theatre, they're on the stage, they're performing, they're giving their all, they're in front of an audience. For a director, we give our all in the rehearsal room, and that's where we really, really do our work, and nobody ever gets to see that. So to be an assistant is to get to see that. And you can hear Sam Mendes or a bunch of other directors, me, I guess, to an extent now, talk about what we do. But you have to bear in mind that we are, by our profession, very, very good talkers and think on our feet. And none of that would be as useful as informative as it was for me as watching someone like Sam in a rehearsal room trying to help an actor or unlock a scene or maneuver an actor whose performance is in the wrong trajectory or at the wrong angle to a different axis. And what's fascinating about that, and what I learned most from watching Sam and Nick Heitner and Phyllida Lloyd and a bunch of other famous directors, and the most important thing I took away from it, is that you cannot be one of those other people. So what I couldn't do is go into a rehearsal room and pretend to be Sam Mendes, or even particularly use Sam Mendes techniques or Phyllida Lloyd's techniques or Nick Heitner's techniques. Actually, what you have to do, like all art, and I suppose sport is like this to an extent as well, is be in a place of self-knowledge and understanding of who you are and what your weight is in a room and what your personality is and how that interacts with other people before you can use your craft as a director to try and get them to move anywhere. So when I started directing, after I assisted Sam, I made a lot of mistakes because I tried to pretend to be some of those directors I'd assisted when I came up against a problem. And actually, that was completely useless. The most important thing was to understand who I was and how I presented to the people that I was talking to and working with, and then work out with them what the solutions are, how to rehearse a scene, how to get the play on its feet, how to get better performance out of them as actors.
So I think whenever you're talking there about the performance, that this, I think the only way that I can try and broaden this out to not just sport or, you know, being in the worlds of film or theatre, is really about problem solving and using your creativity to get past the point that clearly everyone's stuck on because it's not going the way we need it to go to perform at that level. And we all know what that level is in that elite performance world. So how do you try things without becoming so disappointed because they don't always work out?
Yeah, that's a really good question, I think. And a lot of that is about the kind of pure craft of directing. So directing splits into two things, right? Getting the thing on, making it look fantastic, telling the story, and all of the sort of visual stuff generally that we think about in terms of storytelling. And then there's this other bit where a director, not all directors do this, but this is the kind of director I am very intensely, has worked with an actor very, very hard on their performance and tries to get them to a place where they are excelling and they feel that they're excelling, because often actors can excel and not feel like it. Like the most difficult thing you encounter as a director is when you go backstage and you go, that was amazing. And they go, it was awful. And you go, wow, we're mismatched. And how do I convince you that that was really great and that you performed? So I would say, and let's see where our languages might match up in terms of sport and business and theatre and film performance here. It's my job to remove impediments. So it's my job as a director to make sure that your path to expression, think of expression as story, right? You're telling a story in your performance as an actor, doesn't have anything in the way that's going to trip you up. So I need to smooth your path through it. So you're right, it's problem solving. What's getting in the way of this scene? What's getting in the way of this moment? What might you need to come at with your technique as an actor? What might you need to come at with your emotional life as a human being to get this thing properly expressed? So how do you get rid of impediment? Then there's another thing, which is how do I get you to, you know, we talk about, it can sound a bit wonky this, right? But to go to places, like we often say an actor went to a place. And I think we know what we mean by that, because I think we've all seen performances on screen or on stage where the hairs on the back of our neck have stood up, or where we felt this incredible sense of lightness, or we've kind of risen what the actor's doing. And we feel that in sport as well, right? And that for me, actually, strangely, that I talk about that in terms of rise, but as a director, I often think you need to think about that in terms of fall. So you need to create a structure for an actor within their performance where they know that if they take off and do something that is soaring or extraordinary or massive or make a really big choice, that when they come down from that, they're going to hit solid ground, that they're not going to find themselves unable to do, let's take an example, a really big emotional moment. Like, it's possible for most actors to do something huge emotionally. Yeah, they can go there. So you have to help them get up there. But you also need to tell them that they will be safe within the context of the scene they're playing. So they're not going to be too big. Yeah, they're not going to be overacting. People aren't going to think it's shit. That it is to some extent grounded in truth. And also what's happening around them at that point means that it will feel beautiful and right in the context. And then you have to kind of get them down from the other side with whatever you're doing within the scene or the shot or the, you know, the work that you set up. So a lot of it, and it does really quickly start to sound parental directing. I'm not a parent, but as we've established, I've got a really strong mum, right? But the kind of removal of impediment and the smoothing of a path, and also allowing people to feel safe. Now, the third thing I would say, and this is really important, and I've spoken kind of in a slightly weird way probably about what a rehearsal room is, but it's a space where everyone needs to be really secure and really safe and able to make mistakes. And if you screw up in that space, you've got to work with people as a director, and ensure this is true in coaching as well, in any form, where they don't feel shame. Because what you're asking people to do is sometimes make an idiot of themselves or try something or go somewhere. So you need to create an environment and an atmosphere where people feel capable of doing or trying anything, and they don't, if it goes wrong, spend the rest of the day or the week sometimes dragging their heart around, feeling like they screwed up or made themselves look really stupid, or feel like they lack craft or that they're bad and they can't do it. So a lot of that is about creating an environment, you know, and I use laughter a lot. Like, honestly, if you can get people to laugh in a rehearsal room, I think in a meeting, in an office environment, anywhere, not at each other, but there's a lightness and there's a way to release tension. That's a tremendously important thing, particularly when you're thinking about really, really serious stuff. And it's also, I think, about always giving people the confidence that to the right extent as a director, you know what you're doing and you know where you're going. If you want to set up an experiment, you need to go, this is an experiment. If you want to try something, you need to be able to go, we're trying something. We don't know if it's going to work. Let's go there together. Don't just set people off with no sense of what the destination is and what it is that you're trying to get and to achieve.
Today's podcast is sponsored by CSS Investments, a London-based regulated stockbroker that offers a bespoke advisory investment service for stocks and shares. I've personally used CSS for over 5 years now and happily recommend their services. You can find out more at css-investments.com. But please do remember that, as with all investing, your capital is at risk.
Now, Josie, we've been kind of talking about the performance levels and how you kind of help people, whether it's your performance or helping others to achieve their performance. But whenever you become the director on a movie, your first feature film, suddenly you're working probably at a whole other level of pressure, budgets, you know, the whole environment. That seems to me goes from that kind of performance genre into more of a leadership role. Now, how did you deal with that?
So I think probably the thing that best prepared me for being a director of a multi-million dollar film. So for various reasons, it turned out that the first thing that I ever tried to direct on film was a massive thing. So it was a relatively big budget movie with a lot of scale in it. And certainly being a theatre director and having worked with actors and with designers and work creatively as a storyteller for a long time was very helpful to that. But probably the thing that was the most helpful was exactly what you identified, Paul, which is the leadership role. And I had, by the point at which I directed Mary Queen of Scots, which was my first movie, I'd run to relatively big institutions. So I'd run the Bush Theatre in West London as an artistic director and chief executive. And I'd been the artistic director of the Donmar Warehouse that you mentioned that I ran up until a couple of years ago. For enough time that I'd experienced some quite tough leadership challenges that there's not businesses, okay, they're charities, but they've got relatively big turnovers, they're quite big staffs. I'm producing other people's work as well as producing my own. I'm programming stuff. I've got a board of trustees I report to. So probably being in that world and being able to cope with quite big headline conversations, as well as being an artist and a creative person, was, I think, in terms of directing a feature film, the most helpful thing.
Who did you think that maybe during your time, as you were running those two different theatres, who did you think that kind of either helped you the most or did you learn from the most? Because, you know, whenever I was introducing you, you've worked with pretty much all of the biggest actors. And as you talked about Sam Mendes at the start, you've worked with, you know, the best of the best. So were any of those that you really took some from specifically?
So I had, when I was running the Bush Theatre in West London, we had to do this massive thing, which is find a new building, get the new building, buy it or get given it, refurbish it, open it. So basically open a theatre because the venue that the theatre was in when I took over was just falling apart. And I had an amazing chairman during that time, who's a guy called Nick Starr, who used to run the National Theatre. So he was the executive director of the National Theatre, not the other. So he ran all of the business and the operation of that huge institution. And now has actually opened the Bridge Theatre in London, which is a big new theatre that he's built and opened with Nick Heitner, who was the artistic director of the National. And Nick was an amazing chairman. And I think I'd had wonderful mentoring from people like Sam up until the point that I met Nick. But he was the first person I'd met who was really helpful from a sort of business point of view and incredibly good at helping me to imagine large scale projects like opening a theatre. And he's got certain ways of thinking and operating that I've just got such love and admiration for. But the thing he did that I found the most helpful, and this is a great technique if you're trying to get a project to happen. So we're trying to open this theatre, right? And we'd have these meetings, and he'd always, as he was talking about getting to the point where we open the doors on this theatre, make sure that he would progress end goal, even if we were miles away from it. But what he would do in order to do that is he'd talk about what we knew and what we didn't know and what we had and what we didn't have. So he'd kind of go, okay, we've got the will of the board to move this theatre. He would do it in much more detail, but we've got the will of the board, we've got this great architect, this architect's kind of free then, so we can kind of do that there. We know we've got this much capital. We know that we need to raise that much capital. We don't know where we're going to get that money from, but let's say we know that, and we know that we need to identify that. We need to move Hammersmith and Fulham Council sort of to over here. We need to meet someone who's going to help us with them, but let's say we need that person. And then we can probably get the government to give this amount of funding, and we sort of know how to do that. And then we can open a theatre. So within that kind of chain of opening a theatre, what you've got is four things that you've done and two things that you've not done. Now that's a big macro level, and he would do that on a more micro level. Mm-hmm. But what's amazing is that he would call those things placeholders. So often where a kind of project or an idea, creatively as well as in business terms, falls down, is an unwillingness to kind of go, we need to do something that's sort of like this thing here. Yeah, like putting a sort of post-it note with we need something here written on it in order to progress through an idea. And that technique of going, let's get right to the end, let's get to the place we want to be and identify what the things are that we need to have, but do that in a positive way that presumes that we can get them, is almost one of the most useful things that I've found in life, particularly as a film director, where you might go, we want to go and shoot up that mountain. What are the things that we've got that get us there? What are the things that we don't have? Let's assess it and work out what we need. It's a very simple, very brilliant technique. And certainly it's got me up a number of mountains, literally and also metaphorically over the course of my career.
Yeah, I was going to say absolutely the metaphorical side as well, because again, this just brings me back to, you're starting off as kind of as a director in your kind of probably late teens, early 20s, then you're suddenly running to huge institutions, and then you're the director of this multi-million pound, feature film, bringing all of that together on the movie of Mary Queen of Scots with the likes of, you said, Margot Robbie and Saoirse Ronan and all the other actors and crew around there. That just seems like such a massive project with so much pressure and probably so many moving parts that were all involved in that, and also ultimately you're responsible for.
Yeah, and I definitely nearly cracked a couple of times under the pressure of that. That was a proper kind of bite off, more than I could chew at certain points, just because I'd never done it before, And I had an amazing producer, Tim Bevan, who runs Working Title with Eric Fellner, who I'm working with again at the moment. And actually, Tim again is one of the people that I've met in my life who's been the most extraordinary champion. And has that attitude of going, it will be okay, just do it. And it was, it absolutely was. But definitely there were points at which I felt gigantically out of my depth. I would say part of that, and another thing, just because I think to go, not how did I fall down, but how did I get up? One of the things that was so beautiful about working on that film with those two actors, Margot and Saoirse, who are both still in their 20s, so they were, relatively young women when they were doing that, and I think I was sort of just turned 40 around that time. They were so amazing, and they were so brilliant at helping me understand how to help them as actors. And I remember you're put under a lot of pressure as a director correctly to complete, so not going to overtime to get all the shots that you need that day to do all the coverage. And I think with women particularly, often what you're praised for and rewarded for as a kid is being a good girl, like doing your homework on time, completing things, being neat, being tidy. And a lot of the time in my practice as a director, I have to check my neatness and my sense of completing things and really sort of look out for looking for the praise that comes with being too perfect and putting a bow on things because, as part of my gender, that's what I was rewarded for when I was growing up. And Margot, we'd done a couple of days shooting, and one of the ADs, the assistant director, comes over and says, Margot wants to see you in her trailer. And I'm like, oh shit, oh God, what's happening? And I go into a trailer, she's getting a makeup off, and she sits down and she chats to me. She says, listen, I just want you to know this. You don't have to finish the day on time. You can always ask me for more stuff. You will, as a director, be put under pressure to do things on time and on budget, and I will help you in every way I can to do that. But if you need something, take it, and I'm here for you, and I've got your back. And I just think it was absolutely, I mean, she's a leader, actually. She's a leader and a half, Margot, right? She's incredible. But I just thought that was absolutely extraordinary to, as someone who is much more experienced in film and on screen than me, and as a brilliant, and she's a very modest, very humble, woman, get me in and say, listen, if you need something as another artist, take it and take your time, and I'm here as one of your leading actors to defend you and support you in it. It was just an amazing, amazing moment. And actually, in a way, it was a bit like being directed. It's what I'd spent most of my life as a theatre director saying to actors is, take your time, I've got you, I'm here to support you, it's okay. So it was just the most wonderful gift, actually.
Well, the fact that you're, a professional storyteller for, in your craft, I actually have goosebumps just listening to that story, because that is incredible. And you must have been so nervous, like you said, whenever the biggest star asked to see you in the trailer, and you're thinking this is gonna be, what have I done wrong potentially, as opposed to their supporting you. That just, speaks volumes about her. And but then it also, I kind of picked up the sense there from you that you're a bit of a perfectionist, but surely that must be really, really difficult on a movie like that when there are so many things that you need to try and do. So how do you counter wanting to be a perfectionist and not being able to?
Actually, it's my dad who solved that for me. Who and it took me until I was in my 30s to understand this phrase of his. But he says this thing. I don't know if it's his. I like to think it is. Is no solution, no problem. And what that means, and again, it took me until I think I was about 33 to wrap my head around this, is if something cannot be solved, then it's not a problem, it's a fact, and you have to flow around it, right? And I have a tendency to treat everything like something that can be solved or fixed or pushed through or got to the other side of, you know? Everything to me is a kind of flowing river that we've got to get across, right? And that is actually what I say to myself when I let something go, no solution, no problem, because you need to come to a degree of acceptance that you might not get that shot, that you might have failed that day, that we talk about days in film, right? Did you complete the day? Did you get everything you needed? And actually, I can only really improve as a director if I accept not only a degree of failure, like I'll do huge projects and they won't work, they'll fail commercially or they'll fail creatively, or, you know, that's a really important thing. But also if I accept that everything we do has a bit of wiggle room of failure in it, that there's no such thing as perfect, which is not to say that you don't need goals. And actually you can't lead without goals. You can't lead if you don't say to everybody, we need to try and get over here. Here's how I think we're going to do it. Does anyone else have any thoughts about that? Am I wrong? Tell me. Okay, great. Let's go. But yeah, wiggle room, I think. And wiggle room in which you can forgive yourself for not getting things right is important as well, because the amazing thing about film, even more than theatre, is that it performs the most extraordinary daily reset, right? Because often, particularly when you're shooting on location, part of the pressure with time is that you've only got that day, you're in that place, you can get those shots, you can shoot that scene, and then you're gone. You can't go back there. You can't drive all the trucks back there and get all the people back there. So the next day, you're in a completely different place. You know, you're on a battlefield one day, you're in a bedroom the next day. You know, so you can't return to that space, and you have to turn up at 6 o'clock or 8 o'clock the next morning with a completely reset attitude. You have to restore factory settings on yourself. And that's an extraordinary discipline, I think. And one that's slightly different from that in theatre, where you carry some of the weight of what occurred. In film, you're like, right, what's next?
Well, that resonates really well for me, because every day that I would have gone into training or after every match, really, no matter how you performed that day, the next day is always a reset button.
You're listening to the Psychology of Success podcast with Paul McVeigh, sponsored by Moment Digital Limited, live streaming and video producers creating live event content that looks like TV shows, broadcast quality without the cost. Check us out at moment-digital.co.uk.
Now, Josie, I wanted to touch on something we sort of maybe probably went over a little bit too quickly earlier on when we talked about that uneven balance in this industry of theatre and of film as well. So I know that you're probably one of the few females who has been artistic director or directing these big budget movies. Do you feel like you're a trailblazer, or is it just something that you just want to do and almost whatever happens after you've done it, whatever will be, will be?
It's a really good question. I mean, I think that, you know, what will be with me, and yeah, I'd be disingenuous to say I wasn't proud of it, is that I was the first woman to run the Donmar, and probably within the kind of, you know, past sort of 30, 40 years or so, run one of the major London houses. Immediately as I did that, loads of other people started doing it. Loads of other women started doing it. So although I will never not be proud of being the first, that's a double negative, what's important is that more people came afterwards. And what I think I'm good at is putting my shoulders to stuff and pushing. So I think I am good at getting somewhere, pushing through something, making stuff happen. So I'm very kind of doing stuff focused as a human being. You know, I spent last week, the beginning of last week, shooting this vaccination commercial for the NHS. And it was going to be one thing and it was going to be another thing. And, you know, I managed with an amazing team to put together a really big idea and concept and production number and shoot within the space of a few days. And I'm the perfect person to do that kind of thing. If you go to me, we need to get over there, or we need to solve this thing, I'm the right person to do that. And I sort of feel that within the context of change, that is and has been my role. I would say two really important things, one of which, talking about things that I am proud of, the thing that I am most proud of is that I think now six of the directors I work with as an artistic director during my time at the Don Mar, so people who came in and directed shows as part of the program of work that I was curating. It wasn't just my work as a director, it was other people. Six of those people have gone on to be extremely successful artistic directors. So on some level, all of those directors looked at me doing the job of artistic directing and running somewhere and went, yeah, I can do that. And I think that's hugely important. And those are not all, shall we say, white men. And that's really important, yeah? So I think to make things look possible, to be really careful that you're not going, I'm the first and I'm exceptional, but I'm the first and this is possible. And it's very, very doable, this, within my kind of bigger arc of loving doing stuff, is hugely important to me. The other thing I would say is that, okay, amazing that another woman has won an Oscar this year. So fantastic. Also, there is, I think, always and necessarily some kind of check and some kind of deep breath that needs to come with the idea that she's only the second woman in the history of the Oscars to do that. Now, it's not all about awards, but it's a good metric, right? The thing that I would say is that when I joined the British Theatre, it was unbelievably white, unbelievably male. And over the course of the 10 years that I was in leadership roles within those institutions, within a decade, it changed massively. So I would say you can make change, definitely not there yet, but you can make change within a decade, but you really have to try. I think film's beginning to do that now, but it takes effort, it takes thought change, it takes pushing, and you have to be really, really strong about it, but it is doable. And I think that a thing that has changed probably actually over the course of the past year is that people saying you can't really do it, you can't really find the people, it's dropping standards. You know, we interviewed a bunch of people, but we didn't find anybody who could do it, so we went with this person. That actually has shifted to a place where that's no longer acceptable, where you just have to fix it and do it and get it right and make change. And that's very, very positive. And I've seen that happen relatively quickly. So the thing I would say that's very important about what I stand for is less that I was the first person to do it, but more that, and I don't know if I was blazing a trail, but more that change is a much more systemic thing that involves a lot of people, not just one person jumping up and down and going, look at how amazing I am, but change is also highly, highly doable.
And I think that's what leads me onto the question of, okay, they might have looked at you and thought, okay, if Josie's doing it, then so can I, because I had that example when I was, a young player at Tottenham Hotspur, and I saw one of my one of the players who came through the youth team with me breaking into the first team, and the limiting belief that I thought I would never get into the first team, seeing my friend do it meant I believed that I could do it because he did. But you just talked about that's almost a systemic change, and how much can you do about that?
Well, as an artistic director, I could do a lot because, I would hire somewhere around 100 to 120 people a year, some freelance, some on permanent staff. So, there's a shed load I can do because I'm in a hiring position. In terms of diversity, what I can do is make sure that not everybody in Mary Queen of Scots is white, like that, just like a really straightforward thing. And, I still get lightly trolled on Twitter for that. Not that I'm bothered about it, but it was something that at the time, and this is only a few years ago, right, we made this movie, was felt to be exceptional and we had to push for. That's now changing. Period drama's changing. It's now becoming a thing where you go, or some people going, why is your period drama for the screen an entirely white movie or an entirely white television series? So, there's always stuff that you can do. There's always stuff you can do. And also you're never doing enough. And the feeling that you're not doing enough is really, really important, I think. Continual questioning of your own adequacy in terms of how you are creating opportunities, using your power as a person who has the power to give other people a job. Like that's one of the most powerful things you can be as an employer, because hiring someone, getting work for someone, setting up a project where people are hired, you know, and also as a director, having the ability to conceive and set up a project that results in a bunch of people getting work. So powerful in this past year, right, when so many of us have been so heavily unemployed within that period, it's really kind of made me think very, very deeply about what that thing is. So you have the power of being an employer, and you have some of the power of deciding who gets hired. And that's massive. That's a massive thing. You can create huge change that way.
Okay, well, I can't believe that we've only got a few minutes left of our time today, Josie, because this has been so interesting, so intriguing to hear these stories and what you've needed to do to get to the level you've got to in your profession. Got a few questions. I want to try and wrap them all up into one, and I know you've got the ability to take them all and answer them in order. So first one is,
okay,
what has been the price of your success? And then I'm going to quickly, the two quickfire ones that I would normally ask at the start is, what would you have seen as success when you were starting your career? And what do you see success as now at this stage of your career? So what's the price of success? What was success for you at the start? And what is success for you right now?
The price has definitely been my personal life, I would say. I've not spent enough time on the relationships that I have had. And I've been a genuinely appalling girlfriend to some people. So I think that probably, and you know, one of the reasons I stepped down as an artistic director was to enforce a little bit of time on myself where I did concentrate on my personal life and I wasn't just working so relentlessly. So I am definitely not one of those blissful shining adverts for women can have it all. Which is not to say that I'm not, you know, I have huge happiness and huge joy in my life, but I just sacked off a lot of relationships that I probably should have focused slightly harder on. So I would say that. And I would encourage everyone to not take my example and think harder about it. I think at the beginning of my career, what was very important to me was getting things right. And something we talked about earlier was a kind of degree of perfectionism, which is a wonderful thing to have because it amplifies your technique, but isn't a great thing to have because if you're creating things, stories or images, it doesn't necessarily always challenge or innovate your practice. So if you try to be perfect, you're never going to get further. You're only going to get to a goal that you set within the limits of what you believe to be your own skill. And also, there is that thing with women where we have that voice that says, be a good girl. Yeah. So I think what success looks like for me now is actually challenging myself to ask deeper questions of the narrative standard that I've set for myself in the story, how far I think a story can go, if I'm telling it in the right way or the right direction, and not to look to be perfect, but actually to look for a greater degree of innovation or profundity within what I'm doing. So in a way, success for me is dropping the idea of I did that so neatly and looking for a different version of success where I feel like I'm moving on. There's another thing that I know I really need to do, and this is a kind of sort of success goal that I'm setting for myself, is my technique as a filmmaker is very, very poor because I didn't start in there and I didn't train in it like I did in theatre. So there isn't the sort of depth to my technique and craft that I really, really need and want. So like Mary Queen of Scots, right? I spent every weekend watching YouTube videos about filmmaking, like everyone from Martin Scorsese to two dudes with a camera in a film school in LA going, this is how you don't cross the line, right? And it was an accelerated way to train myself. But what I really, really want to do is spend some time focusing on my technique, because then I'll be in perfect control of my expression. And in a way, I would look at that for me as a balance between being perfect and really challenging myself to express stuff. Like in film, I need to be more perfect with my craft in order that I can get to a greater depth of expression as a filmmaker. Is that really boring, Paul? I'm sorry. It's probably a bit, yeah.
Josie, honestly, absolutely loved it. It's so fascinating. I really have enjoyed just exploring your world because it's so different from mine. But then, of course, as you made so many analogies, there's so many common themes and subject. But I like the way you dumb it down just so I can understand. But no, listen, thank you so much for your time. I really, really, really appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, well, I'm going to go and let my mum back in the kitchen.
Josie Rourke, what a woman, what a trailblazer, what an incredible career she has, and so humble and so modest. But as she rightly put it, she didn't come from a working class background, it was a middle class background, but still to go on to Cambridge University to be the artistic director of the Dalmar Theatre, and then to go and be the director of a multi-million pound movie, Mary Queen of Scots. I think there were so many lessons in there from Josie that can be applied across business, sport, and for your personal life. I hope you really enjoyed that, and I hope you can follow us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Please like and leave a review and join us for our next episode of The Psychology of Success. And a final thank you for everyone involved in making today's show. From producing it, we've got Moment Digital with Neil Stainsby and Peter Wright. Hayley Brasnett is the editor. Dave Webster has been our researcher, and Emily Drake helps get us out all of our social media posts on the psychology of success.